In part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering crystal balls, dancing dolphins, pewter wizards, dragons, and fairies. International Galleries also offers custom framing services for your fine art print, posters, photos, needlework, and fabric art. Rush service is always available.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frayne at the controls. Just quick mention that tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be talking with another candidate, this case, we'll be talking with a Democrat who will be in the primary. There will be a primary for the Democratic side of things in the 15th Congressional District here in Illinois. There are two Democrats who will compete in the primary. Then one of them will go on in the general election to face Tim Johnson, who is the Republican incumbent congressman here from our area. We'll have both of the Democrats here on the show. So tomorrow we'll talk with one of them, first of these conversations. His name is Ralph Langenheim. And then in the second part of the program, we'll shift the focus and we'll talk about national politics, talk a little bit about where things stand now in the presidential contest. And our guest will be Walter Shapiro. He's political columnist for USA Today and has written an interesting book that looks at what happens in the run-up to the primaries in that part of the process where maybe reporters are paying a lot of attention, but a lot of other people aren't. And he's written a book on this. It's titled One Car Caravan on the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In. So he'll talk about that and also kind of about where things stand right now. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with someone who is probably one of the biggest names, best-known people, who work in the science of complexity. And if you're not sure what that is, we will explain it to you in the course of the conversation. His name is Stuart Kaufman. He was originally trained as a physician, also is a biologist, and has done a lot of research on complex systems. He has a medical degree from University of California at San Francisco and had a short medical career. After that, he moved into being interested in doing work on developmental genetics, and he held appointments at University of Chicago and later on at University of Pennsylvania. And he became known, well-known perhaps to a lot of people, when he became involved with the Santa Fe Institute, which is a nonprofit research institute dedicated to the study of complex systems. He also, back in 1996, started the BIOS Group in Santa Fe. That's a company that employs complex systems methods to try to help businesses solve some of their problems. He's written three books, Origins of Order, from 93, At Home in the Universe, 95, published by Oxford University Press. And we talked about that book, in fact, here on the show. And also his most current is titled Investigations. That came out in 2000, also published by Oxford University Press. He's here visiting the campus and will be involved in a conference that is intended to mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of a British-born scientist named W. Ross Ashby. He was a psychiatrist and worked in Britain as a psychiatrist for much of his life, but also for a period of years between 59 and 1970, he was professor of electrical engineering and biophysics here at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he is known as one of the founders of cybernetics and general systems theory. So this conference will be taking place here on the campus. In fact, it begins tonight, and our guest Stuart Kaufman will give the keynote talk. So that's why he is here. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You, in your work, are thinking about some of the most basic questions, I suppose, one can, being, what is life? How did it start? Where did it come from? What does it all mean? You couldn't quite take on questions much bigger than that, I think.
Well, I guess it's true, David. I've studied, I've studied problems concerning the origin of life. My last book, Investigations, which is, I'm very proud of it, but it's an odd duck of a book. It really is. Tries to get at what may be a physical definition of life. I've studied genetic regulatory networks and ontogeny, namely how you get from a fertilized egg to a newborn baby or newborn flower. I don't think that makes sense. Flowers don't get born. And I've studied evolution on rugged fitness landscapes and coevolution, and I've published in economics, and I even have two papers in quantum gravity under the general theory that every Jewish fruit fly geneticist should do something about quantum gravity.
Well, I'm interested in maybe talking about some of the really basic, in basic terms for non-scientists, some of the things that you're interested in. And I guess I think maybe of all of these things, the central idea is this idea that when we look around us, we look at living things. They are very, very complex, remarkably complex, astoundingly complex. It just sort of takes your breath away, really, when you look at life and the forms in which it exists and how individual living things are very complex and they manage to arrange themselves into connect themselves in different ways that are also very complex. You look at the web of nature, the living things, it's just astounding, which leads a lot of people to the question, how did it get that way? Where did it come from? Why is there life at all? And a lot of people have different ways of explaining that, and some people would say that, well, you know, the only way you can explain that is to say there was some creative entity out there who started things going, and of course there are other people who say, well, no, maybe there's a different way of looking at that. And what you have written a lot about is the idea that within nature there is an inherent tendency toward complexity. It's something it's there, and if you start looking, pretty soon you're going to start seeing it everywhere.
Yes, I have written about that, and of course, I don't want to deny the famous second law of thermodynamics, which most of your listeners will know about. I mean,
you'll have to remind us.
Okay,
well, I think I know what the first one is, but what is the second?
The second law is the famous law that says that entropy or disorder increases all the time. I found proof of it by looking at my desk.
Mine too.
Disorder only increases on my desk. But an example, a perfectly good example of the second law in action is to take a petri dish and put a drop of ink in the middle of some still water that's in the petri dish, and that drop will diffuse outwards. And the basic explanation for it is that there's a lot more ways to separate than there are to come together again, and that tendency towards disorder is what leads to diffusion. And the second law states that for closed thermodynamic systems, it's not so clear for open thermodynamic systems, a closed thermodynamic system is an idealization in which you have a box, and in it there are some particles, and they're banging around and bumping into one another. Maybe it's a gas in the simplest case, like I'm talking about. And suppose you started with all the gas molecules in the upper corner of the box. Then you waited. They, too, would diffuse outward until you got to a state of essentially equilibrium where the gas molecules were more or less evenly distributed around the system. So there is, according to the second law, for closed thermodynamic systems, an inexorable tendency for disorder to increase. Now, that's for a closed system where no matter and no energy can come into the system. So it's an idealization of the real world because there really is no closed thermodynamic system. And living systems certainly aren't closed thermodynamic systems. We eat and excrete, and we are displaced from equilibrium. The only time we're at equilibrium is when we're dead. So now let's step back and look at the universe. It has, in fact, gotten extremely complex. There was, we think, a Big Bang about 14 billion years ago. And all there was a quark gluon soup in an expanding space-time, which, and you should really have an astrophysicist or a physicist here to tell you about this, not me, because I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm not even a physicist, despite publishing on quantum gravity, for which I thank Lee Smolin very much. He was my co-author, and he's the expert, and I'm not. Anyway, the universe has gotten very complex. Now, there are some physical preconditions for the universe getting complex, and if my friend Phil Anderson, who's a Nobel laureate in physics, were here, Phil would say, and I accept his view, that the universe couldn't get complex unless it were expanding. And the idea is, because it's expanding, essentially there's a heat sink where we can dump disorder. We can dump the randomness. So in order to create order, you're creating disorder somewhere else. And so you have to have a place to dump that disorder. And the idea is that the expanding universe allows there to be a forever cold sink that you can dump disorder into. Okay, so that's way back. A major overview of what's going on. But even if that's true, we're confronted with the question of why did the universe get so complex after all? I mean, why do we have stars? Why do we have galaxies? Why do we have clusters of galaxies? Why do the stars have planets around them? Granted that there are planets, we know at least one, namely ours, where a biosphere has happened. And the biosphere, the more you look at it, the more stunned you become by it. Because here is this system in which, as far as we know, life started about 3.8 billion years ago, first chemical evidence of life, which is only about 100 million years after the planet cooled enough to have liquid water on it, and before the infall, or after the infall of meteors would have kept obliterating any life that started. So life started pretty fast. Now, either it started here by itself, or it got here from somewhere else. So there are those who like the idea of panspermia, namely that life is drifting around in the universe. And there is a possibility, by the way, that we should hold in mind. It's possible that there was life on Mars, because now we know that there's water on Mars. And it's just conceivable that life got here from Mars, because if you kick a little bit of rock off of the Martian surface, because, say, a meteor falls and blasts something out into space, it takes something like a minimum of 15,000 years for that particle to make it to Earth. So it's possible that life could have hitchhiked from Mars to Earth. So we've got to hold that in mind. And it might be going the other way, too. But otherwise, we have to think that life started on Earth. So it can't have been an enormously improbable process if it only took 100 million years to get going. That then leads into, and I don't know if you want to talk about it now, I can tell you with pleasure the alternative theories about the origin of life, if you want our discussion to go that way.
Well, I guess I'm still back on the idea of the tendency, if you put the pieces together, that you're saying that there just is this tendency for them to kind of arrange themselves to come together to form little bits that are a little bit more complicated than the pieces, and then for those bits to come together and form pieces that are more complicated than those pieces, and that there is this sort of natural tendency for these complex systems to organize themselves. And I guess that's one of those things that I think a lot of people would maybe have a difficult time with the idea. Well, why should that be? Well, why should that just happen?
Let me try to explain. Well, let me first of all say that I think we should all be stunned at the complexity of the biosphere. I mean, here we have something like 100 million living species that are endangered by our actions and global warming and other things. But everybody, I think, knows that there's been major extinction events in the past 600 million years where 50 or 60 or 90% of all species go extinct, and we may be causing one of them right now ourselves. But in any case, the biosphere is vastly complex and interwoven and interlocked. So the question is why? Mm-hmm. So let me try to answer what at least I think are the factors that give rise to all of this, and how profound the puzzles are about it. Because I nobody's in charge of the biosphere. Nobody's in charge of the global economy either. So why has the economy gotten so complex in the last 1 million years or 2 million years or 3 million years? There's a lot more ways of earning a living now than there were 3 million years ago. So nobody has a theory for that. I have the start of a theory for that, but that doesn't mean that it's any good. So let's sort of start and look at this. The first thing we have to do is we have to get something that is living. We've got to get going with life itself. Now, let me just sort of briefly answer to the question that I'm posing, namely, what are the current theories about the origin of life?
Okay.
Most of your listeners know about the famous double helix of DNA. And it's a magical molecule. It's just spectacular, if you think about it. Because here you have Schrodinger's aperiodic crystal from his book, What is Life, with the two outside helices of sugars and phosphates, and then the four bases, A, T, C, and G, lined up on the inside in Watson-Crick base pairing. And so anybody who looks at that molecule realizes, as did Watson and Crick when they first published the structure of DNA, that it suggests its own mode of replication, because an A on one side, adenine, specifies that there will be a T on the other side. So if I read down one side of the broken apart double helix ladder, I know what I'm supposed to put on the other side, and that's called template complementarity. So as soon as you see that molecule, you think, gosh, what a neat way of reproducing, because this complex molecule with its ordered and information-laden sequence of bases can just copy themselves. Okay, so that leads to the first hypothesis about how life started, namely it started as a self-replicating, template-replicating molecule, either DNA or RNA or something like it. To summarize 35 years of chemical work, nobody's gotten raw DNA or raw RNA to replicate by itself, in the sense that if you take a single-stranded RNA molecule or DNA molecule and you add the free bases, A, T, C, and G, or A, U, C, and G, you can't get it to replicate and then the strands to separate and then just continue. For lots of good chemical reasons, it's failed. That doesn't mean it's always going to fail. But it does mean that the early hope from 30 years ago and 40 years ago that we would understand the origin of life as simply getting template replicating DNA molecules is not a go so far. Okay, so maybe if you have failed for 35 or 40 years, you should put a question mark around it. Okay, it doesn't prove that it's wrong. It just proves that it's not so easy after all. That is to say, in the absence of an enzyme, like the enzyme that copies DNA, which is a polymerase. But enzymes are proteins, and we've got to get from DNA to proteins, and for that we need all of the stuff about how you get from DNA to proteins, which is transcription and translation. And that's a very complex thing. Then there's the RNA world hypothesis. I'll keep this brief because I want to get to the biosphere. But the RNA world hypothesis is built upon the fact that it's been discovered that RNA molecules can not only carry information, they can carry out chemical tasks like catalysis. So everybody got very excited and said, gee, one class of molecules can do everything. Instead of just having proteins doing catalysis, which is the speeding up of a chemical reaction, maybe RNA can do it all. So very smart people are trying to evolve RNA molecules that can act as polymerases and copy any RNA molecule, including themselves. And they may succeed. Okay, so Dave Bartel and Jack Szostak, Dave was a student of Jack's. Jack's at Harvard Medical School, and David is now at the Whitehead Institute, are working very hard evolving RNA molecules essentially to do something like that, okay, and making progress. So it's possible we'll get an RNA molecule that can copy itself. Now, I happen to hold a radically different view, and part of it has been experimentally proven, and the more radical part is a hypothesis. So this idea is the following, that suppose chemistry were a little bit different, like the constants of nature were a little different, and you couldn't make a double helix. Would life be ruled out? And I want to believe that the answer is no, that what life really depends upon, what self-reproduction really depends upon is what I'll call collective autocatalysis. So the simplest idea is a molecule that catalyzes its own formation out of some parts of itself, okay? But if A can make itself out of parts of itself, now imagine we've got two molecules, A and B, and A catalyzes the formation of B out of parts of B, and B catalyzes the formation of A out of parts of A, okay? Now you have a little collectively autocatalytic set, and I emphasize the word collectively okay, because there's no molecule that reproduces itself. The system as a whole has the property of collective autocatalysis. So it's a holistic, it's holistic by its very nature, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we could have two molecules that catalyze one another's formation, why not 10 or 100 or 1,000? Now, the next statement is, and this is true, cells in your body, all free living cells, are in fact collectively autocatalytic systems. There's no molecule in you that catalyzes its own formation. When DNA gets copied, it does it by transcribing RNA, which makes the polymerase I was talking about, which copies the DNA. So you need this whole complex web of catalysis and reactions and so on to close on itself and give you collective autocatalysis. Now for some facts. A guy named Reza Gadiri, who's a brilliant organic chemist at Scripps, has made some proteins, and he's made collectively autocatalytic sets out of them. So collective autocatalysis has been done with proteins, and it's been done with DNA. So that's a done deal. Okay, that's no longer a question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, I have a theory that I'm just going to mention briefly, then I want to get to the biosphere. The added theory besides collective autocatalysis that I have done both by myself and with Don Farmer and Norm Packard a number of years ago at Los Alamos is that if you have a rich enough soup of molecules, namely with sufficient diversity, okay, and if you ask that these molecules can be substrates and products of reactions but can also catalyze reactions, okay, then under a wide variety of assumptions about who catalyzes what reaction, you can show that when you get to a critical diversity of molecules, you just get autocatalytic sets. They kind of crystallize in the soup, okay? And the reason is that you catalyze so many reactions that all of a sudden you're bound to get big extended webs of catalyzed reactions that close on themselves and have autocatalytic sets. And this is a kind of a phase transition mathematically, in a complex chemical soup. So if I'm right about this piece of theory, and this part is still theory, it's testable, but it's still theory, it says that getting self-reproduction wasn't so hard. Now, I used to think that was adequate for life. In my last book, Investigations, I found myself saying that life requires not only self-reproduction, it requires the doing of a work cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So this has to do with the complexity of the biosphere and something that I call the adjacent possible in my third book, Investigations. So perhaps I can take a moment and explain it. A work cycle, like a locomotive engine or the famous Carnot cycle, where Carnot analyzed heat engines, okay, always links what the physicists call a spontaneous process, one that'll happen anyway, okay, like a ball rolling downhill, with a non-spontaneous process, like pushing a ball up the hill. So work cycles in engines always link a spontaneous and a non-spontaneous process. Chemically, those are called, the spontaneous process is called exergonic. You're giving up what's called free energy. And a non-spontaneous process is called endergonic. You're shoving the reaction uphill in the direction it doesn't want to go. And you have to add energy to the system to do that. So I think there's something very deep about this idea that living organisms are both self-reproducing and do work cycles, because it's by linking together work cycles between organisms that amazing things happen, like building a redwood tree due to photosynthesis, which then gets linked into the building of the cellulose and the other things that make the tree grow. I mean, if you think of how stunning it is that light's falling and there's a seed, and you wind up with a redwood tree. I mean, that's just amazing. It's just utterly amazing. But not only do you get a redwood tree, you get the redwood tree which has a habitat for worms to live in it, and worms live in it, and they're reproducing too, okay? And then you have woodpeckers coming and digging out the worms. Okay, so you have life creates niches for life as it expands into what I call the adjacent possible. So what's this adjacent possible? Roughly speaking, it's where we can get to in one step from where we are now, okay? And chemically, you can see it easily. Suppose you started with a soup of chemicals in a pot. Now think of all the reactions those chemicals can undergo with one another. The chances are good that if you let the reactions happen, you'd create some chemicals that weren't in the pot to start with. That So let's just think about that. The molecules you started with is what I'll call the actual. The molecules that can be created that aren't in the pot in one reaction step, or what I'll call the adjacent possible. Mm-hmm. Then you have new molecules in the pot, namely the ones you've just created, and they can react with themselves in the original molecules and create still new kinds of molecules. So you keep expanding chemically into the adjacent possible. I hope I'm getting the idea across intuitively. Now, what's amazing about this is that the biosphere has been expanding into the adjacent possible chemically, for sure, in the last 3.8 billion years. We started with maybe 50 or 100 or a couple hundred organic molecules on the Earth, and there's trillions of organic molecules on the Earth now. Well, how do we get them? Well, we got them by expanding into the adjacent possible via a variety of mechanisms. But the same thing is true at the level of species, at the level of morphologies, at the level of behaviors, at the level of, you know, in the human culture, at the level of, you know, cuisine. Like you can get Chinese-Cuban cuisine now in the United States. So we're always popping off into the adjacent possible. Mm-hmm. And so now I can now I've said enough that I can round back to the start of an answer to the question of why at least a biosphere gets complex, okay? Mm-hmm. I think a biosphere, and then I think the same thing's true of the global economy, gets complex because, at least for the biosphere, you have self-reproducing things, they're organisms. So Darwin's mechanism of natural selection and heritable variation steps in. Once you've got self-reproducing things and heritable variation, Darwin's right. You get natural selection. Okay? But natural selection is acting on organisms as they explore new niches that are in the adjacent possible. So what that gives you is organisms find cunning new ways of making livings, and then they provide niches for other organisms to make livings out of the organisms that are already there, and you keep expanding into the adjacent possible. And it is this expansion into the adjacent possible for non-equilibrium systems as we eat and excrete, okay, and as we link our work cycles with other organisms that is, I think, driving this complexification of the biosphere. So probably that's enough to say on it. Mm-hmm. At least I can talk about the biosphere getting complex, where we have mutation and natural selection to help us. I'm not a physicist, so I can't talk about why the universe gets complex based on anything like Darwinian natural selection. There must be something else going on. But the universe has sure gotten complex.
We have couple of people who like to ask questions, and we want to bring them into the conversation. And I will introduce again our guest, Stuart Kaufman, someone who is very well known in this field of complexity, has become well known through his association with the Santa Fe Institute, a place where they're very interested in studying complex systems. And he also started back in 1996 his own company that looks at this way of thinking about complex systems and applies that to businesses who are interested in solving their problems. He's got a medical degree from University of California, San Francisco, and is interested in biology, complex systems. He has the author of three books, and if you're interested in exploring these ideas in a little bit greater detail, you might look at his most recent, which is Investigations, 2000 Oxford University Press, or the one before that, At Home in the Universe. We have several people here. Cell phone caller first. We'll go to line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I've read all your books in detail, and I particularly like Investigations. I must tell you that in the last 15 minutes, I followed everything you said, but I think you probably lost 80% of the audience in the middle of that. So I'd like you to step back and give an explanation of the following. Explain in which way, when a scientist asks why, it's different than when a layperson asks why. In other words, to talk about teleological explanations as opposed to mechanism explanations. A lot of people will ask why. I was just reading a book on evolutionary psychology today, which is basically an attack on the field, where they talk about why men don't ask directions. And they are talking about a lot of those kinds of questions are based on the assumption that it must be for a good reason as opposed to being a side effect of something else. But when you're talking to religious people, particularly, this problem about why, the way scientists ask it, isn't the same as the why that they're asking. So could you comment on that, please?
Yes, but you've raised a really tough question. First of all, let me give you the standard answer. The standard answer is that scientists don't ask why, they ask how. Namely, they ask how something works. They don't ask why questions. They ask how questions. I mean, that's what Newton did when he gave us his three laws of motion and the law of universal gravitation. He says, "Here's how the celestial mechanics of the solar system works, and here's how shells do it when they do it." There's not a why in that. It's all how. It's all mechanistic. Now what you, I think, properly did is drew attention to teleological explanations. And teleological explanations are ones where you give an answer about, you know, why did you go to the supermarket? Well, I needed to buy some horseradish, to pick a random example. I don't think I've ever gone to the supermarket to buy horseradish, and I guess you can get horseradish at a supermarket. Sure. In my third book, Investigations, which I like, but I think is a strange book, I start out by asking, I seduce the reader into a why question. Let me give it to you, and then spout a bit of philosophy. I say, think of a bacterium swimming upstream in a glucose gradient. Now comes the seduction. It is, we would all say of the bacterium that it's going to get food. And in fact, we would all say of the bacterium that it's going to get food. That is to say, the bacterium is acting on its own behalf in an environment. And I've just seduced you into teleological language because I have the word act in there, and on its own behalf, and going to get food, and so on. That's not a mechanistic explanation. That's not an explanation in terms of the machinery by which the bacterium manages to go up the glucose gradient by sensing a gradient in the glucose and altering how it flips its flagellum around. Now let's ask whether or not moving to teleological language is justified. And of course, there's an enormous philosophical literature on teleological explanations. I'm somewhat familiar with this literature. I'm not an expert on it, despite having a philosophy background. I think that we're confronted with the following thing. I think you can always give a causal explanation, namely the mechanism by which the bacterium actually manages to go up the gradient. And, you know, maybe if we leave out consciousness and just think about trees adapting and trees behaving in certain ways, like sending out chemical messages when they're being attacked by insects to, quotes, warn other trees, unquotes, we won't get ourselves into problems about consciousness when we think about teleology. Although in full-fledged teleological explanations, consciousness really comes in because I really did go to the supermarket to get some horseradish. And I think we're confronted here by what the philosopher Wittgenstein called a language game. That we have sets of concepts like mechanistic explanations and sets of concepts like teleological explanations, and you cannot get from one to the other. I mean, that's a very brief way of saying that you cannot reduce statements about teleological explanations to mechanistic explanations. They just have different ontological assumptions. And I have the hunch that in the end, we're never going to find the reduction of teleological explanations to mechanistic explanations. We just do make the jump. I'll give you another example of such a jump that Wittgenstein talked about, then come back to make a point. If you were to describe a legal proceedings like Joe Blow is found guilty of murder, that language presumes that you know all sorts of things about legal proceedings, like responsibility and evidence and due process of law and testimony and guilt and innocence and the capacity to be responsible or not responsible for your actions. All of those concepts are wrapped up in it. And Wittgenstein would point out that you cannot reduce language about a legal action to language about just what people are doing. So we, the jury, find Joe Blow guilty of murder cannot be translated into some list of statements about what people do, because there's lots of ways that a jury could find Joe Blow guilty of murder, and you can't find a necessary and sufficient set of conditions about what people are doing as they twitch in their chairs. So this is another example of another language game. Now, if that move is right, namely we just have to jump, then we can ask, where do we apply teleological explanations? And the answer is we apply them to living things. Chairs don't have purposes, but living things do have purposes. And my hunch is that my seduction is not ill-founded, namely that we begin to apply teleological explanations even to the simplest living things, like the bacterium going up a glucose gradient. So the conditions for the applicability of teleological explanations relies on the fact that there be living things. Now, I have not succeeded in telling you this, in reducing teleological explanations to mechanical explanations. I don't think you can. What I've done is I've said there are minimum grounds that you have for a teleological explanation to be something that makes sense. And then, of course, you can argue with me, well, maybe the bacterium really doesn't have purposes, and you might be right. I don't know. But at least you got to be at the level of something like a bacterium to make a teleological explanation. So I hope that helps some.
Well, we are coming here already into our only about 15 minutes left. We have some other callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Let's go next to Savoy, line two. Hello.
Hello. Right at the beginning, you said a fascinating concept that to create order in one place, you had to create disorder in someplace else. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that slightly.
Well, I can. I'm not a physicist, but a physicist would say for a closed thermodynamic system, so I really should be careful about what I say. For a closed thermodynamic system, to create order in one part of the system, you have to be creating disorder somewhere else because entropy can only stay constant or go up. Now, I've been told by my physicist friends that this statement about the second law is only valid for closed thermodynamic systems where no matter or energy can cross the boundary. I've also been told by my physicist friends that my statement may be wrong if you think of the universe as a whole and you include gravitation. So we really don't have a theory about, at least not that I know, about what entropy and the increase of entropy means for a system that includes self-gravitating objects. I may be wrong about this, so take what I'm saying with caution. But that's what good physicists have told me. So what I said is certainly correct for non-gravitating closed thermodynamic systems. That's just the received view in thermodynamics. I'm not certain that it's true for the universe as a whole with self-gravitating objects in it. So probably that's all I can say about it.
All right. Thank you very much.
I want to, if I could, ask what seems to be a basic question, but I'm sure that it's not easy. For a lot of people, I think one of the most fundamental sort of problems here, the question is, well, how do you get life from non-life?
Right.
Now you have sketched out a way that could happen. I guess the question is, why is it you think that nobody's yet actually been able to do it? It's proverbial life in a test tube. No one yet has been able to actually make that happen.
Well, nobody's tried. If I still had my laboratory at the University of Pennsylvania, by now I'd have tried. what has happened is that Reza Gadiri has actually made, by cunning chemical construction, okay, self-reproducing collectively autocatalytic sets. He's made a protein that can reproduce itself, namely a single autocatalytic molecule, and he's made sets of molecules where I help you get formed and you help me get formed.
Right.
Okay, so he's made collectively autocatalytic sets. Nobody has yet tried the experiment of taking lots of substrates and products that can also be catalysts, like, for example, small proteins called peptides, and asked if it's the case if you get to a sufficient diversity, do you get autocatalytic sets experimentally? Now, Michael Steele in New Zealand, I think he's in Christchurch, and Wim Hordijk have just published a paper in which they followed up on the original work that I did and I did then with Don Farmer and Norm Packard, and they've shown analytically that in a chemical reaction soup, under well-specified conditions of the assumptions, there's you do get the phase transition that I'm talking about, and you get collectively autocatalytic sets. So I showed it analytically, then we showed it numerically, and then Steele and Hordick have shown a more far-reaching analytical analysis of the conditions under which you get autocatalytic sets. Now, it's not yet known whether or not real chemistry fits those conditions, but it's a doable experiment. I mean, what you would do is make millions or hundreds of millions of small peptides or middle-sized peptides, which are small proteins made of 20 kinds of amino acids, in a pot, and ask whether or not you start catalyzing reactions, then ask whether you start catalyzing lots and lots and lots of reactions, and then ask whether or not you get a set of molecules that catalyzes its own formation out of simple food molecules that you keep feeding into the set. So it's a doable experiment.
Mm-hmm. And you think that at some point someone actually is going to do it?
I sure hope so.
No, I mean not just attempt it, but demonstrate that in fact that it.
Oh yeah,
it can,
listen,
it can.
Yeah,
it can work like
yes.
that.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
All right, let's go to line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. It's been strenuous mental exercise to listen to this.
That's what we like on this show: strenuous mental exercise.
But I hope it was not so strenuous that you fell off the treadmill.
Well, luckily they archive these shows, so I can always go back if I fell off. But I have a quick question and another question. I hope you take more time with. And what the quick question is: do you know who Conrad Waddington is?
Yes, he was a friend of mine, and in fact, my mentor. And until he unfortunately died. Yes, I certainly know. And he was called Wad by his friends.
Okay, well, that explains a lot for me anyway. My longer question would be, it seems to me that if you recall the whole face on Mars controversy, it seems to me
You mean life on Mars?
No, face on Mars, you know, where they were saying there was a they had a photograph that looked like there was a sculptured face on lying flat on Mars. And,
oh, I vaguely remember it. Yeah,
yeah. And people were saying that, we're thinking, hey, geez, you know, it looked like somebody intelligent was there. And then it turned out just to be a trick of perspective. But I was just thinking that it seems to me that scientists would have had a hard time not resorting to some sort of intelligent design, some notion of intelligent design, if that face had really existed, you know?
Yes.
And so I'm thinking, when you talk about self-organization being kind of embedded in the physical world, what would it take for you to succumb to some sort of
design theory?
Yeah, in your exploration of self-organization.
Gosh, I've never asked that question to myself. I've debated one of the design theory people. And let me say at the outset that the design theorists are roughly saying there are some things that are so complicated, like the face on Mars, that had it turned out not to just be a weathering pattern of some kind or whatever caused it, that there are some things that are just so complicated that their presence suggests design. And let me give an example that says, to me anyway, that what they're saying isn't a priori stupid at all. We're listening to signals from outer space and trying to find if we can hear anything that is signs of intelligent life, you know, in the SETI project. Now, suppose we got some sort of funny signal, like it turned out to be in Morse code and it said, George Bush is running for president of the United States, you know, or some weird thing like that. Then the design theorists would say, how complicated does the signal have to be for us to say that this does not come from natural sources, that it's designed? Now, that's actually not a stupid question. That's an important question, and we can imagine getting signals from space, and we would wonder whether or not it was a fluctuation or whether or not it was designed. And they've attempted pretty hard to try to write down what they consider to be intelligent conditions to say that design would have to be invoked. Then they make the move of saying that in biology, organisms are so complex that we have to invoke design. Hidden behind that, of course, is always the question of who the designer is, but they carefully avoid that. Of course, the implication is that it's a creative force, and it's God who's busy doing the designing. I don't think that they've made their case successfully in biology. There's around three or four writers who've written on this subject, basically they take complex holes where it's whole holes, and they say, but this thing wouldn't work if you only had part of the system. But where did the whole system come from? It's too complex. Now, biologists are aware of this problem, and one of the answers to it may be what's called Darwinian pre-adaptation, which is the idea that things evolve and then are recruited to new functions in a funny environment, and then are recruited successively to new functions in new environments and come to be complex holes that look in the end as if they couldn't possibly have arisen, but you're thinking of them in terms of the final environment and the final function that the whole has, but that's not the way they arose. They arose, for a simple example is the idea I don't remember the example I'm about to tell you, but you need to just bear in mind this idea of what Darwin called pre-adaptations, that an organ which is normally used to do X can, in a funny environment, be used and selected for because it has another causal consequence that allows it to do Y. And by successive changes in the selection criteria, you could build up a complex whole without it having been mysterious at any step.
Well, I think it's somewhat comforting to know, or at least I feel, you're not actually looking for God in your studies. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. But that is what I think interests me, though, is, and I think we probably talked a little bit about this with At Home in the Universe, is that you still find, without resorting to God as an explanation, you still find ways to talk about things like purpose and meaning and for life to exist.
See, I think meaning comes in. That's why I think this question of the bacterium swimming up the glucose gradient, which makes it into what I call an autonomous agent, namely something that can act on its own behalf. So I've once again seduced you into teleological talk, okay, self-consciously. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing. For that bacterium, the next molecule that comes in is either yuck or yum. Okay, mm-hmm. So for that bacterium, there's good and bad. I'm not attributing consciousness to the bacterium. I have no idea whether bacteria are conscious or not. I don't understand consciousness at all. It's the only problem that I'm completely terrified to try to tackle.
I'm glad to hear there is one. Yeah.
Well, I'm not terrified to attack it. I've just never done anything very successful in thinking about it. I actually have a couple of ideas about consciousness, but I'm so embarrassed by them that I wouldn't allow them to be published with investigations. I had it as a 12-page epilogue, and I said, the book's wacky enough. I don't need to put in my strange ideas about consciousness. It seems to me that once you've got living things, purposes naturally enter. That was part of my saying that teleological talk need some grounds to apply, and I think that the minimum grounds are the minimum living things, which, as far as I know, are bacteria. We could debate about viruses, okay? But they don't. Viruses don't fulfill my definition of an autonomous agent, which is that it's a self-reproducing thing that does a work cycle. But bacteria clearly do fulfill that. So I just make the teleological leap at that point. So, yes, I do talk about purposes. Yeah. But then I talk about another kind of purpose, too. Well, not a purpose. A kind of sense of at-home-in-the-universe-ness,
right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Which is that if life is an expected consequence, namely a roughly inevitable or highly probable consequence of chemistry and catalysis and number and chance, which is what my theory says, then then we're not an incredibly rare and improbable accident in the universe. Life must be rife in the universe. And that makes us expected, and in the sense that we're expected instead of an incredibly rare accident, if that claim is true, we're at home in the universe. I mean, it is natural that we'd be here in this universe. I mean, there's a question about why the universe is like it is. Okay, I mean, maybe the universe would have different constants of nature and it would just pop into existence and go out of existence a short time later, or it would expand forever as a cold, dark soup. So you have to tune the constants of nature to get to our universe, and nobody knows how that tuning happens.
We are we're almost at the point where we're going to have to finish. I feel like I should apologize because we have some callers I know that would like to engage you, but we just simply don't have time to do it. I'm not really even sure that if I gave somebody a chance now, they'd really have much of a chance to state their question, and you'd have much of a chance to respond. Maybe what sort of if we really learn how to do this to make the thing happen that you to reproduce in the laboratory what you believe actually happened in nature, what would that enable us to do? Do you think what sort of practical applications?
Well, it's a funny thing you should ask me that. When I came up with my idea about autonomous agents that's sitting in investigations, I thought, gee, I could patent this. And then, honest to gosh, as a non-religious person, I thought to myself, if I have stumbled across an adequate definition of life, which I won't insist on because somebody will kill me, it's God's work, it's not mine. And I shouldn't patent it. So I didn't. I wrote investigations instead. Suppose that we could make self-reproducing systems that did in fact do work cycles. Mm. Well, things like that can build things because they do work cycles. They swim up glucose gradients. So my suspicion is that 50 to 100 years from now, we are going to be creating self-reproducing systems that can build things that we want them to build, maybe on the nanoscale. Yeah. Okay? And a whole new technology awaits us that could be as important as the computer revolution. After all, if I'm right, autonomous agents have built the biosphere, and that's as staggering as the biosphere is. So if we could ever harness that power to do our technological bidding, we will have created new life forms that can build things for us.
We're going to have to stop there. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're interested in reading more from our guest, look at his 2000 book, Investigations, or At Home in the Universe from 1995, Stuart Kaufman. Programming here made possible with support from the Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Sergio Luca, Wellington's Victory, and Leonora No. 3. Complete the concert Saturday, March 13th, 7:30 in the evening in the Follinger Gerd Hall at the Krennert Center for the Performing Arts. More information at 333-6280. Also, the broadcast is made possible by 10,000 Villages. Their 12th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental Rugs will be held March 5th through the 13th at their store at 105 North Walnut, downtown Champaign. An informational seminar about the rugs will be held on Tuesday, March 9th at 7 p.m. For more information,